Welcome to the Project Censored Show on Pacifica Radio. I'm Mickey Huff with guest host Nolan Higdon. Peter Phillips will be back next week. Today on the program, we look back at the good news stories of 2014. We'll be joined by Sarah Van Gelder of Yes Magazine. In the second half of the program today, we talk to Professor Robin Anderson about the ongoing propaganda and controversy surrounding the hacking of Sony Pictures, the new release of The Interview, and newly announced U.S. sanctions against North Korea. Please stay with us. We're not commodities or cogs that turn to global economy. We're the promise of a legacy, a spirit we're honoring. An anomaly to those who can't imagine a world without oppressive forces slaving for a mighty dollar bill. We won. We got the love of the brothers and our sisters. Welcome back to the Project Censored Show on Pacifica Radio. I'm Mickey Huff with guest host Nolan Higdon. Today's program, we look back at the good news of 2014. With our first guest, Sarah Van Gelder. Sarah Van Gelder is a writer, public speaker, and co-founder and editor-in-chief of Yes Magazine. Sarah edited one of the first books about the Occupy movement, This Changes Everything, Occupy Wall Street and the 99%, and the anthology, Making Peace, Healing a Violent World. She lives in Washington State, and she joins us today by phone. Sarah, welcome to the Project Censored Show.
Thank you so much, Mickey. Glad to be here.
I should say welcome back. It's a delight to have you back. You wrote a piece at the end of 2014 called 10 Ways Human Rights and Democracy Won in 2014. Yeah, you heard that right. In other words, and this is what's so wonderful about Yes Magazine, has been the historic focus on positive news stories that are also overlooked. And of course, at Project Censored, we have worked with you at Yes Magazine, and you have contributed so many wonderful things to us over the years, including a great foreword in our Censored 2014 book. So again, it's a delight to have you back on the show. Sarah Van Gelder, tell us a little bit about this list that you came up of 10 ways that human rights and democracy won in 2014. What are some of these things? What were some of the highlights?
Just a little bit of framing on that. You know, we look at good news not just because we're trying to cheer people up, but also because it suggests ways that we can move forward. Where are there openings for real change? And so that's what I was looking for in this story, because as I was thinking about the year, it seemed like quite a brutal year. It seemed like a lot of violence was in the news and a lot of violence was part of people's lives. And I was thinking, you know, is this just about brutality this year, or can we find something else to say about where things are going? And what I was so encouraged by was realizing that the brutality actually wasn't that much greater than in the past. What was different was how many people's movements have taken to the streets and started becoming a really powerful force in combating that brutality. And so I wanted to really focus on the ways that things like Black Lives Matter, that things like those social movements, you know, in that case, led by young women of color especially, have really started to transform things. And that, to me, suggests some real opportunities for 2015.
Well, Sarah Van Gelder, in fact, that story tops your list, Black Lives Matter. And you write here that black men are 21 times as likely to be shot by police as white men. That was according to a report by ProPublica. And that the Pew Center had reported that black men are 6 times as likely to be imprisoned as white men. And so you're highlighting this movement of resistance, calling attention to this problem. And where do you see this going then? Where do you see the positive avenue sort of opening up this dialogue about police violence and the lack of transparency and accountability?
Well, what I see is a national coming to terms with this kind of pattern that we've seen actually for a long time. I mean, it's really an uninterrupted history going all the way back to slavery and then the posses that were sent out when slaves tried to escape and the Jim Crow era, the terrorism of lynchings that black families were subjected to. There's a long and uninterrupted history of violence directed against black people that our country has not yet come to terms with. And so to me, the fact that we're looking at that very seriously, and we're looking at it because these people on the streets, these young women especially, people all over the country who've joined in on these demonstrations, they are insisting that we look at it. And that is how change happens. That is how we actually get the kinds of shifts we need. So we have, you know, police departments that, you know, yeah, they're feeling embattled, and a lot of them are just resisting and just fighting back. But other ones, like in Richmond, California, we posted a story on Yes Magazine about the police force there that's really starting to look at those issues and saying, how do we shift from this, you know, no broken windows policy, which you may know is basically a policy that says, you know, if you just crack down on every tiny infringement in especially at-risk communities. So that means, you know, essentially a policy of harassing young people of color on the streets just for being there. You know, they said, we need to shift away from that because that policy clearly isn't working. It's clearly just creating an atmosphere of an occupied community, a police-occupied community rather than a free community. What kind of alternative is there? And they went back to the tried and true notion of community policing, where cops walk the beat and they get to know the local people and they get to be trusted and they're there to be helpful and to protect people rather than to be seen as a occupying force in a force that could bring about arbitrary violence at any time. It's really interesting to see that some police forces are coming to terms with this issue. There may not be an awful lot of cases of that, but I think we're increasingly going to see that the public is going to be questioning the kind of arbitrary violence directed especially at black people and just say, you know what, this is not acceptable. This is not what we want to be done with our tax dollars. This is not the kind of communities that we want to create. We want to create places where everyone can thrive. And, you know, bringing the faces of those particular individuals who were killed arbitrarily by police for doing something like walking in a Walmart store carrying a toy gun that is actually sold in that store, that should be a reason for a young black man to be killed, or a child carrying a toy gun in a park in Cleveland, or a police officer who's patrolling a dark staircase in Brooklyn and gets spooked because he hears somebody coming down the stairs. I mean, those are not acceptable practices to allow African Americans or anyone to be subjected to that kind of violence.
We're in Berkeley, California, and in Northern California, Sonoma County, where we live. I mean, of course, that happened with Andy Lopez and Sonoma County Sheriff. I mean, these incidents are occurring all over the place. And I was happy to hear you go back and look at the history of it. I'm an historian by trade. My co-host today, Nolan Higdon, is also an historian, and I think he'd like to chime in here for a moment.
Yes, sir. You talked about the awareness that's starting to arise concerning Black Lives Matter. That also fits into your second story as well. You talk about how white folks are reevaluating privilege in the second story. Can you tell us a little bit about how that fits into what your first story?
Yeah, sure. I mean, I think there's some ways in which our whole society's become divided. So white people just have a whole different experience in many cases. They go about their lives believing that if they're stopped by police, they can expect to be treated with respect and to be safe, and they can go to police if they need help. And that's a different experience than many African-American communities have. So this whole movement has been opening up the eyes of a lot of white folks who just didn't really understand that was the experience that a lot of black folks were having. And one of the indications of that was the hashtag, which became quite controversial, but I think it's still interesting to look at, the hashtag on Twitter that was Criming Wall White. So a bunch of white folks got online and said, you know what, I was pulled over and treated with courtesy, or I was pulled over and actually I was doing something illegal. Maybe I had a little bit of marijuana or something. Maybe I'd been going too fast, but the police officer told me to watch myself and sent me on my way. And the realization that a lot of white folks were having that wouldn't have been the case had they been a person of color. So I think there's that kind of coming to terms with, is this okay to have these two different sets of experiences in our society, and how are we going to change that?
Sarah, as I look at this list, this thorough and inspiring list, one of the stories really jumps out at me. Sort of just seems to have a different title than the rest of the stories, is story number 7, which is titled War on Terror Blows Back. And I think this one needs a little more of an explanation than the title gives it. Could you explain that story to us?
Sure. And yes, there's a lot under that category, so it's hard to summarize in one short title. But we're now ending the wars in Afghanistan and Iraq, and yet instead of feeling that we have accomplished something with all of those lives lost and destroyed and so much money spent, I think most Americans would look at that and really question whether we accomplished anything and, in fact, whether Iraq or Afghanistan is better off or whether we're more secure as a result of those wars. And I thought the one fact that The Guardian pointed to about the genesis of ISIS was a particularly chilling version of that. They said that of the 25 most important leaders of ISIS, which is, you know, this new wave of very harsh and violent Islamic rule that's moving across Iraq and Syria, that of the 25 most important leaders of ISIS, 17 of them spent time in the Iraq prison Camp Buka or one of the other prisons run by the United States. That was an opportunity for them to actually meet each other and to spend time planning this insurgency. And they noted also that they were just a few hundred meters away from where the Al-Qaeda leadership was being imprisoned, and they could learn from them as well. So, you know, rather than helping to support a move towards more democracy or more openness or more inter-ethnic peace, we've actually created, through the violence and the chaos that we've inflicted on that region, we've actually created the conditions for a far worse future for those people. You know, I think people are starting to look at that blowback question. Can you go into another region and mold that region to the purposes of your country, in this case, the United States? And if you do that, what is the outcome? So it really calls into question this approach to foreign policy that the New American Century folks, the neoconservatives, Don Rumsfelds and the Dick Cheneys tried to bring about, which was, you know, it's our century. We're going to make it the way we want it. And I think this really shows that that's an utterly bankrupt and immoral policy.
You're listening to the Project Censored Show on Pacifica Radio. I'm Mickey Huff with guest host Nolan Higdon. And the guest in the first part of the program today is Sarah Van Gelder from Yes Magazine. We are speaking with Sarah about an article she wrote at the end of 2014, 10 Ways Human Rights and Democracy Won in 2014. We just got done talking about story 7 on your list on War and Terror Blows Back. And story number 6 seems connected to this. It's the release of the Senate Intelligence Committee report on torture and calls for criminal investigation. So democracy scores one over tyranny is part of your headline. And we've seen other countries already looking into potential international criminal trials against people in the Bush administration. So let's talk a little bit about that. You're focusing on the positive side of the fact that this is actually coming out after it had been lied about and covered up for so long.
Yeah, I think that's an important thing to note, is that I think the CIA was trying very hard not to allow this particular report to be issued. And all along the way, we're really questioning Senator Feinstein's staff about their access and their right to actually make this information public. And I think it's a really important moment for democracy that it did, in fact, become public, that she stood up to that and that the report is out, you know, redacted, but it's still out. And that is one of the things that distinguishes democracy from a tyranny, that there is that kind of transparency, that government is, in some respects, accountable to we the people. And we have to hold on to that with everything we've got, because that, you know, that is that thin line. And we're seeing so many things with the national security state, you know, with wiretapping and surveillance of people across the board, you know, and things that haven't been exposed but have yet to be reined in by government. So, you know, there's a lot to be concerned about there. So every time we see one of these moments when democracy wins out, I think it's really important that we note it and support it, as well as resist the backward steps of the national security state.
Yeah, I think that's very important to notice. And again, that's the whole purpose of the article here, is to say, yes, we live in complicated, strange, and potentially depressing times, but we also live in very hopeful times, and not the faux kind of hijacked cynicism that we might see from, you know, corporate political campaigns. But there are real grassroots movements of hope and change and resistance to a lot of these problems and challenges that we face. And your list does a nice job of really kind of highlighting and reminding those. By the way, readers can learn more about Yes Magazine by going to yesmagazine.org. That's the website, correct, Sarah?
Yes, indeed.
So people can certainly learn more. And, of course, learn more about your new book. You have a new book. It's called Sustainable Happiness, Live Simply, live well, make a difference. I think this is a good time for us to segue into what are some of the more positive things that people are doing. Again, there's this war fatigue. I mean, even though Obama's talking about the wars winding down, the actions of the wars don't appear to be winding down. Drone strikes are still going on. You know, there's still a lot of this imperial foreign policy happening. However, not only is there resistance to it, there are also ways in which we can live our lives in a positive, proactive way. And you actually wrote about this in the book, 7 Ways to Get Happy Without Costing the Planet. Maybe you could talk to us a little bit about those concepts and also some of the great contributors you have in this book.
Sure. This was a book that we put together late last year and is now out in bookstores as of this week. So we're very thrilled about that. And basically the punchline of the book is that if you want a better world, work for happiness. And if you want happiness, work for a better world. We've been sold this sort of bill of goods about happiness, which is that happiness comes about if we work for ourselves, if we get as much money as we can, and if we accumulate as much stuff, and if we, you know, have the right car or the right house or the right address or the right technology gizmo. But that, in fact, doesn't turn out to be where happiness comes from. It actually comes from having strong relationships, meaningful work. It comes from feeling gratitude and expressing gratitude. It comes from what you give away, what you contribute to the larger community. And all of these are about relationships. They're all about how we connect with the larger world, because we evolved as a cooperative species. So if we want to be happy, in fact, what really makes the difference is the strength of our relationships and the opportunities to give back and to be part of a community in which there is that kind of trust and give and take. So what that means in sort of a political sense is that one of the biggest factors in whether we're going to be happy or not is the level of equity in society. One of the pieces in this book is an interview with Richard Wilkinson, who wrote a book called The Spirit Level, which is all about what happens in a society that has larger amounts of income inequality or smaller amounts. His original research was whether poverty or wealth caused happiness or unhappiness, and he found that there wasn't a strong correlation. The strong correlation was between equality and inequality, because in highly unequal societies, you have much higher levels of teen pregnancy and mental illness and lower life expectancies. And in a more equal society, you have more trust and you have more of a sense that the common good, that people will work for the common good, that they can rely on one another when things are difficult. So the stress of an unequal society has huge ramifications all across the board, including the people who are more wealthy. And the benefits of a more equitable society create happiness across the board. So that's just one of the examples of ways in which, if you want happiness, work for a better world. If you want a better world, work for happiness.
Sarah Van Gelder, you have a great quote from Viktor Frankl, the concentration camp survivor, who wrote, quote, "Forces beyond your control can take away everything you possess except one thing, your freedom to choose how you will respond to the situation." And then you lay out these 7 things that people can do that, of course, dovetailing from what you were just talking about, showing up for your life mindfully, kicking addictions, find work that's meaningful, things you love to do. And you also talk about giving the gifts of time and celebrating gifts of you might have or others have. I mean, these are all quite simple things, but in order to be mindful and to put ourselves in a frame of thinking where these things are ready, they're there for us on the front burner, so to speak, that's a really important step, particularly when we face so many challenges. Is that not so?
Oh, yeah, indeed it is. I mean, Viktor Frankl is sort of the classic example of a man who came to these realizations while being interned in a concentration camp. So we, all of us have our challenges, you know, whether they're in our personal lives or trying to get by on not enough economic resources or being jobless. You know, we all have our challenges, and we also still all have choices. And that's one of the main lessons from this book, is the choices that we make can contribute both to our own personal happiness and also to the well-being of our larger society. One of these is about time, and that one I think is so interesting because, you know, advertisers will spend billions of dollars convincing us that we have to have all this stuff to be happy. But actually, if we buy all that stuff, we tend to go into debt and we tend to have to work longer hours. Getting back to Wilkinson's thing about inequality, people in unequal societies actually work on the average of 9 weeks longer every year than in more equitable societies. So we end up letting all of our time get sucked away into these different things that are all about buying and taking care of and using stuff. And we give up our freedom and we give up the time that we can spend hanging out with friends or with our kids or with our parents or, you know, just pursuing a hobby or a creative outlet or a spiritual life or time in our community. There's so many things that we know can bring happiness and well-being, and yet when we let stuff and money dominate those things, we don't have time for those things.
Indeed, and Sarah Van Gelder, choosing things that you love to do and finding work that you love to do, that really connects a lot with your other article on 10 Ways Human Rights and Democracy Won in 2014. There were a lot of people choosing to work on the things that they loved, on social justice, on climate justice. And, you know, going back to your other article, the Climate March was something that was very important that inspired millions of people. There's another Climate March coming up this spring. Maybe comment on that a bit. I know Yes Magazine and you all were involved a lot in climate pieces, and certainly you wrote about climate for Project Censored a year ago.
I think you could say it's sort of the issue of our moment because it determines whether there will be a world that is habitable in the future for human civilizations as we've known it. If you just look at you know, the potential impact on things like whether we can grow enough food for our huge population and whether people have drinking water and whether our coastlines end up below water, you know, where the majority of people live. Those are not small questions. It's not just a question of a small, you know, change in temperature. So these are just enormous challenges, and I think gradually people are coming to terms with that and to some degree go through that classic set of attitudes that you go through when you've gotten a death sentence, you know, denial and then anger and then bargaining and so forth. And so different people go through that at different times. But I think increasingly people are coming to terms with the fact that, you know, we really have to make some major changes in our world if we're going to be able to, that the planet is still habitable for our children. That's a pretty radical notion, and it's not one that falls into the normal political categories because you can't negotiate with, you know, the climate. You can't say to the physics of the planet, you know, we wish you would put this off a few more decades while we get our act together. It just happens. So much of certain chemicals in the atmosphere cause so much other things to occur. So, you know, it's we humans that have to figure out how we're going to adjust our lives and how we can make sure that nobody is sacrificed in that process. It's not a question of saying, well, you know, the poor folks are just going to have to pick up and leave because they're not going to be able to survive. We could have huge climate refugee issues. So we have this challenge in front of us, but also the opportunities of creating a much more sustainable and actually happier world as we address those challenges.
Sarah, that fits in well with what you were talking about earlier about this functioning democracy. And that fits into your fifth story about how the governor of New York hears activists and bans fracking. Could you talk a little bit about that story as well?
Yeah, and I think that's really an interesting piece of this whole climate challenge we're in right now. We actually published a piece at Yes Magazine about the climate negotiations in Peru that concludes that whatever happens on the international negotiation stage, it's not going to be enough. What's going to be enough is what we, the people, demand in all of our respective communities and in all of our respective countries. So New York State is a great example of that because there have been these really adamant fracking activists who've been just saying to the governor of New York, you know, our drinking water for centuries to come is more important than the immediate profits of a bunch of gas companies. We don't want our, you know, our entire area turned into a polluted wasteland, you know, our entire aquifer to be turned into a wasteland so that somebody can, you know, dig some wells, get some natural gas, and then leave. And Governor Cuomo was not originally inclined in that direction, but he said, okay, after all that pressure from the activists, I'll do a study and, you know, see if this is really the case. And it turned out the study said it was the case. It has impacts on health that are unknown and potentially very dire, and it has impacts on seismic activity. And he said, okay, I will let the science rule in this case. But it took the activists to be pushing and pushing and pushing for him to even ask that question and to be willing to stand up to implementing what the report would suggest he should implement. So, you know, when people think, oh, what good is it to go out on the street and demonstrate, or what good is it, it just seems so futile, that is actually how things happen, and it's actually having success.
Sarah Van Gelder, on your list, you have Cuba. Allegedly, we're seeing the beginning of normalized relations, possibly with Cuba, recognizing their medical expertise and helping people against Ebola. You also have on the list opposition to Trans-Pacific Partnership, sort of the NAFTA on steroids. We also saw Hawaii banning GMOs. We've seen the legalization of marijuana, including in Washington, some other states. I mean, again, there's a lot of things that are going on here that are part of democratic grassroots movements that are creating changes in the way society is structured.
Absolutely. Yep. I mean, that's what's so exciting about this time we're in, is that people from the grassroots up are making choices that are oftentimes very different than the political folks inside the Beltway. And I think, you know, I think the news media often gets mesmerized by, you know, John Boehner or Nancy Pelosi or what they're saying, what they're doing. But meanwhile, people are moving on. I mean, I think there is so much in that realm. People want a different kind of a life, a different kind of a world, different kind of community, and they're going about creating it, and they're not waiting for Washington, D.C. to get unstuck.
Sarah, what's next? That's how you end your piece. What's next here, then, for us in 2015? As we head into 2015 with the challenges we're facing, what's next? What hope do you have to offer for folks? And we certainly invite people to go to your excellent website, yesmagazine.org. Sarah?
I think we're starting to redefine what it means to have a good life, to have a middle-class way of life. I think there's a great deal of discontent with the huge inequality that continues, and I think we'll be seeing more people like Senator Elizabeth Warren and others calling for reining in of that 1%. But meanwhile, there's also the question of how do we want to live? What does it mean to have a good life? How can we live in a good way that can also sustain the planet, can prevent more of the damage to the climate that we're seeing? So I think there's a whole exploration around that. A lot of it is happening in the form of the cooperative movement. People are really excited about how cooperatives can work so that people's work time is as empowered as the time that they spend in their communities, is as empowered as the time they spend in their families. How can we make our workplaces not only places where we feel like we have some power, but where we can shift the kind of production we do to make it sustainable, to make it good for all the people and not exploitative. So I think there's a lot of possibility now for people to really rethink, you know, what does it mean to have a society that's fair? What does it mean for it to be more genuinely inclusive? You know, how do we make sure that everyone, women and men, people of all colors, all races, all backgrounds, all feel safe in public spaces and can exert their opinions and can make the communities their own? How can we make sure that everyone has that opportunity? And then I think we'll be able to deal with the crises as they hit us from climate change or from whatever other source, because we'll be able to turn to each other and support one another instead of turning on one another.
Sarah Van Gelder, thank you so much for all of your work over the years at Yes Magazine. We invite listeners to stay abreast of what's happening at Yes Magazine, yesmagazine.org. And your most recent book is Sustainable Happiness, Live Simply, Live Well, Make a Difference. Sarah Van Gelder, thank you so much for joining us on the Project Censored show today.
And thank you, Mickey and Nolan. I really enjoyed myself.
Thank you. We'll definitely have you back on as the year progresses. Welcome back to the Project Censored Show on Pacifica Radio. I'm Mickey Huff with guest host Nolan Higdon. Our next guest is a professor of communication and media studies at Fordham University. We're talking with Dr. Robin Anderson. She's the author of four books and dozens of chapters and journal articles and writes media criticism for various publications, including Fairness and Accuracy in Reporting. Robin Anderson has been a judge with Project Censored for a number of years and has contributed to Project Censored volumes. One of her books is titled A Century of Media, A Century of War. It won the Alpha Sigma New Book Award in 2007. She's also working on another book on HBO's Treme, Evolving Stories of the Storm. Recently, Robin Anderson wrote a piece titled Sony, the Interview, and Hollywood Illusions of Creative Expression. This was a very timely piece about Sony Pictures' film, The Interview, where there was a lot of hype built up and an alleged canceling or censoring of the film, and then a releasing of it on Christmas Day. Listeners are likely familiar with this, the hoopla surrounding some of this, but they may not be aware of all of the details behind the scenes. And Robin Anderson joins us today by phone to talk about her article, Sony, the Interview, and Hollywood Illusions of Creative Expression. Robin Anderson, welcome to the Project Censored Show.
Thank you, Mickey. It's great to be here. Thanks for inviting me.
Again, it's just it's a fascinating read and so important. And there have been a number of other articles that have come out, but this one was one of the early ones. And I'd like to talk to you about it. One of the things that you start right out from the beginning here is that there's all these claims about artistic freedom and creative expression and so forth. Let's talk a little bit about your analysis of that angle of the story.
Right. I thought that the media narrative that emerged right after the kerfuffle between Sony and Obama, where Sony canceled and Obama chastised them, saying that you've made the wrong decision, and then everybody in Hollywood was up in arms and was saying that our freedom of expression was being curtailed, and how could we allow this to happen by a foreign power and things like that. And the whole narrative, media narrative, and celebration of freedom of expression just made me question the ongoing censorship existent in Hollywood and the way that so many films are shaped and designed with military help. And so long ago, it seems that Hollywood has abdicated its responsibility and some of its creativity to the government and to other members of the armed forces who are trying to shape the magic dust that is Hollywood.
Robin, let's talk about that. In the article, you mention involvement by the government, the military, in the creation of The Interview. Can you tell us a little bit about what that involvement was and how we know about this involvement?
Right. Well, you know, the whole pre-story, or that, you know, that news cycle of a month where much of the revelation of the Sony emails that were hacked revealed, gosh, all kinds of snarky things about that actors didn't have much talent and unequal pay and very racist comments about President Obama. And among those things that some news outlets and some journalists have been digging through, that whole treasure trove of emails, are interesting correspondence between Michael Linton, the head of Sony Entertainment, and various members of the Obama administration. The Undersecretary of State was one of the ones that was consulted, Richard Stengel, and the script apparently had been vetted, handed over really to Hillary Clinton, and then vetted by somebody at the CIA. And at one point, it was revealed that the idea to make the head of the North Korean state, Kim Jong-un, the villain, did not come from the creators, but came from the CIA via Hillary Clinton.
Well, that and the executives at Sony Pictures, and, you know, you document this in your piece. And again, this is cooperation between the Central Intelligence Agency, the State Department, Sony. Rob Williams, whom you may know in Vermont, who works with us at Acme and Project Censored, he wrote a piece for our Censored 2014 book called Screening the Homeland, where he looked at the scripts for things like Argo and Zero Dark 30. And, you know, they showed, you know, the same kind of patterns of planning, script approval, and so on. And I mean, this goes back a long ways, but I mean, just even in the recent past, you know, The Interview isn't really new, but one of the things that maybe we could talk about is that there was a lot of PR hype and propaganda about this movie, The Interview, which is also a propaganda film. We can talk about that too. But let's talk a little bit about the PR hype. I mean, Sony and Seth Rogen and James Franco, I mean, they spun this as a major, this film centered, you're never going to see it. Then all of a sudden it's going to be released. Then all of a sudden you can download it. It turned out that it's like one of the most profitable downloaded movies already in internet history. I mean, this was all planned, don't you think? To some degree.
What? It certainly could have been. I mean, there were some initial findings that thought, where various execs thought the movie wasn't going to make a lot of money. You know, you can kind of
right.
spin it that way and say, well, let's see if we can come up with some bizarre way to alternatively distribute this movie and see if we can bypass some of the major screens in the country and the big malls and go to a smaller distribution source for a film and see if we can make our money back. And that's not an angle that I would necessarily discount. In the emails, however, there was a lot of talk about how they were going to spin the movie, as you say, Mickey, but also the North Koreans had been, you know, flailing their arms and screaming and taking it to the UN and saying, look, this is you're talking about assassinating a head of state. You're going to incite terrorism. They took it to the UN. They said, you shouldn't do this. But Sony knew all of that.
Right.
And were working back channels with the government at State Department, at the CIA. They were talking about security. They were hosting in their headquarters in Los Angeles. They were hosting CIA types and trying to discuss with them what some of the fallout would be. So what you get in these emails is a lot of discussion about possible ramifications, which in itself is an interesting story, knowing full well that there could be some real ramifications. And, you know, Seth Rogen was quoted in one article, Mickey, that you know well, by Christine Hong, where he said, well, so what if it starts a war? People may look back on it and say, oh, it's a great movie. So
that was incredible.
Seth Rogen is a very nice fellow in this and terrifically irresponsible.
Yeah, Seth Rogen says, and if it does start a war, hopefully people will say, you know what, it was worth it. It was a good movie.
Right.
I mean, not only is that crass, but it certainly underscores the propaganda of the message of the film. I actually saw the film. It was a reprehensible piece of propaganda from my view, and the ending was abhorrently violent and really just literally shows Kim Jong-un being blown up. I guess
right.
that's a spoiler alert for people. But they were building up the hype of this before this came out. James Franco, in fact, originally said that the initial ambiguous threats that North Korea made, they were basically going after Obama as much as they were going after Franco, Rogan, Sony, etc. And then Franken said, quote, because Obama actually produced the movie. I mean, again, sarcasm, right? So he's trying to deflect it and say. And then Rogan goes on to say, quote, speaking about North Korea, this is in Christine Hong's article, Stranger Than Fiction, The Interview and U.S. Regime Change Policy Toward North Korea. Fascinating article. I encourage people to check that out, as well as your article, Robin Anderson at The Vision Machine. Seth Rogen says, quote, North Korea, they don't have freedom of speech there, so they don't get that people make stuff. Pretty amazing. And then he says, throughout the process, we made relationships with certain people who work in the government as consultants, who I'm convinced are the CIA. I mean, this is Rogan talking, right? And then we learn, of course, that State Department officials like Bruce Bennett, a North Korea watcher and regime change advocate at the RAND Corporation, which is a U.S. military-funded think tank, Christine Hong's talking about this in her article, and a consultant to the U.S. government on North Korea, also serves as a consultant with Sony on the film. And then it turns out that Linton at Sony is on the board at RAND Corporation.
Yes, Mickey, and something that I dug up, too, is that Linton was also an Obama appointee for the board of directors of the Voice of America.
Yes,
so
well,
he has
the propaganda.
All kinds of connections. And, you know, my research about militainment and the military entertainment complex has focused on the technology and how the computer-based digital technology of games is really the same technology that we use in drones, and that the profit sharing between government and the commercial industries, so that kind of political economy of the media, are very united. And also we can see similarities in the way that the games and the news and the audiovisual milieu supports a kind of highly militarized ethos. What Sony really advances with the hacking and the interview story, if we look at it carefully, is these literal connections between the studio execs and the government. And that's kind of what's been missing until this. So I think that's what makes this story so profound. The emails that show Linton's connection between the government, one that I unearthed that had been published in a minor source was the talking points that the studio execs were given to continually claim that they didn't have anything to do with the shaping of the content of the film, that it all came from Rogan and his co-producer, and so that this was a legitimate creative enterprise, when, as you point out, it was really shaped. And it, and what Christine Hong points out is it really goes along with the Asia-Pacific agenda of the Obama administration, of that pivot, if you recall, that Hillary Clinton talked about let's now look at China and the burgeoning economy, and let's focus on that. And North Korea is very much involved in that, and almost a scapegoat, and it's held up as a pivotal enemy at this moment. And just like Zero Dark Thirty did in promoting, you know, extrajudicial assassination, now this movie, The Interview, is promoting North Korea as this danger in that area at the very moment that the administration is trying to focus on that area and maintain dominance.
And Robin Anderson, you remember when Zero Dark Thirty won the Oscar, they had Michelle Obama beamed in to the ceremony proceedings?
Yes, but it was Argo that won.
I'm sorry. Argo, that's right. Nolan?
Robin, I think that's what makes your piece so interesting. Not only does it uncover the sort of like international propagandizing, but also here at home, the film is clearly aimed at sort of a younger audience. And it tries to portray the United States and North Korea as very different, in that the United States is a sort of freedom of speech, freedom of expression. North Korea does not. But your article shows that the reality is that the government, the military are directly behind this film. So there is a propagandizing effort here at home as well, to falsely sort of construct this notion of difference between the two.
Yeah, that's the irony that I saw, and I just really was compelled to write it because of that. And in the piece, I tried to give you a little bit of the power and influence that Philip Strub from the Film Liaison Office in the Pentagon has over Hollywood, and how many people and how many studios and big blockbuster films collaborate with them. And everything from Iron Man to Transformers. Transformers was one of the biggest joint military Hollywood operations, where you just had all of the armed forces involved. And very happily, the Air Force said, we came off looking like rock stars. Of course, all of this support by the military, where they get all the fun and the toys and the tanks and the personnel and the equipment, that comes at a price. And the price is to have their scripts vetted and screened by Strub and other aspects, whenever they include anyone, any other part of the armed forces in a movie, that they submit their scripts to these censors, and they are regularly censored and altered, and they accept that. So the celebration of freedom of expression around a movie that the script had been altered, and without the acknowledgement that Hollywood is so invested in the military at this point for its profit margins and this corporatization with the military, is just very disturbing.
It's literally peeling the onion of propaganda here. I mean, the film itself is propaganda. Hollywood propping up the illusion of creative expression is propaganda. And this is fascinating, and I believe worth repetition, because this is not a conspiracy theory. There is a person at the Department of Defense. It's an entertainment liaison office. The CIA also has one of these. This person's name is Philip Strub. And it says here in your article that war films must depict military life as realistically as possible, or assist in recruitment, right, as Act of Valor did. I mean, this is not made up.
Right. No, absolutely not. And Philip Strub is very open about this in statements in the Hollywood community. And he actually says, you know, what realistic means to them in the military means that they're portrayed uncritically. There can be absolutely no criticism. Any criticism of the military to Philip Strub is unrealistic.
Yeah, Leni Riefenstahl would be proud.
Right.
I mean, seriously, I mean, you know, all the other parts of that analogy that fall aside. I mean, the notion, however, that Hollywood is not a propaganda arm of the state is, I mean, anybody that looks into this at all, even just reads your article, would have to realize that that's a lunatic claim.
Right. And even when we're not promoting actual foreign policy or underscoring head of state that's our enemy, we're just kind of in general creating advertisements for the military, for its personnel, and for the huge amounts of money that are spent on military equipment in our economy, you know, anywhere from 50 to 65 to 70% of our federal budget goes to the military. And in Man of Steel, even Superman now shills for the military, in which you see the F-35 jet, which has never flown. It only flew fictionally in Man of Steel, and it's a 1.5 trillion boondoggle on the part of the military, and this film is portraying it as actually something that's real and something that will eventually work, when by all indications this plane will never work.
Hollywood's certainly able to tell tall tales in a single bound, that's for sure.
That's right.
Whether it's Man of Steel, Transformers, I mean, again, your article, though, you know, brief, just packs in so much information that Sony Pictures also was behind Zero Dark Thirty, the film collaborating with the Central Intelligence Agency we mentioned before. CIA Director John Brennan, gave who gives this specious defense for torture that somehow gets into Zero Dark Thirty. And, you know, we were talking to Sarah Van Gelder earlier about one of the good news stories that comes out of last year is that, well, again, torture is not good news. But we finally learn definitively, factually, that there were these torture reports, even though they were lying about it, covering up. The CIA was spying on the Senate committee, even impersonating members of the committee. Again, this is all behind the scenes stuff that's censored, that the public doesn't get to see. So the fact that we did get to have our suspicions confirmed, while certainly the suspicions were negative, the fact that we get to see this and know this, I think, is just as important as what you're pointing out about these Hollywood blockbusters, is that this is not innocuous entertainment.
Right.
You know, this is propaganda, plain and simple.
Right. And the torture report also made it really clear that there was never any valid evidence that torture found actionable information that stopped terrorist attacks. And John Brennan insisted, you know, he got up and he said, we have found useful information that has led to stopping terror. And they've always hidden behind that assertion. And that's essentially implied in Zero Dark Thirty. And I think that's what made your piece in the 2014 book so important, to really examine Zero Dark Thirty and show that all the ways that the representation, I mean, we're in a battle, we're in war, so literally war, but this kind of rhetorical, verbal media war that we are very much ensconced in right at this moment has huge effects on terrorism and war globally. And it's time for these kinds of things to be really examined and explored in terms of how they solidify people's attitudes. One thing that came out in the emails as well was that this relationship between Michael Linton and the Undersecretary of State, Richard Stengel, was that he has again appealed to Hollywood to help with now the global war on terror, particularly focused on the Middle East and Russia. And he has asked Linton to help him get other studios to again start to create narratives and images that will help them with the war on terror. And that translates into, of course, anti-Islamicism, the way that did after 9/11.
We're speaking with Professor Robin Anderson of Fordham University. She's the author of numerous books on media and recently wrote an article titled Sony, the Interview and Hollywood Illusions of Creative Expression. You can find that article online at thevisionmachine.com. Nolan?
Robin, Glenn Greenwald of The Intercept wrote an article, said North Korea, Sony story shows how eagerly U.S. media still regurgitate government claims. I was wondering what you make of the press almost unanimously backing up the claims of the government that North Korea was behind this cyber attack on The Interview.
Right, because so many cyber experts have pointed out that there really is only circumstantial evidence, and the government never gave any real evidence that this was true, but the media just took it as a fact, de facto. And it's terrifically problematic, as you know. We're actually carrying out, and history is moving forward now, between the United States and North Korea, based on a claim that is unsubstantiated, and by all accounts at this point looks as if that it came from disgruntled employees inside Sony.
That's right, Robin Anderson, and this is another example example of the CIA weaponizing information through alleged entertainment in Hollywood in maintenance of perception management, because just now President Obama has announced new sanctions against North Korea. Surprise, surprise.
Right. And I just wonder if Seth Rogen, who continues to portray this film as funny and a comedy, when he says, well, so what if it starts a war? It was a good movie. From a basic humanistic perspective, your film could start a war and yet you don't care. I mean, the kind of loss of a human perspective in all of this, you know, we've been talking about Zero Dark Thirty and torture, but there's real humanity involved in these questions. And the way in which the crass and inhuman way in which Hollywood has taken this on, and underlying so much of it is about profits. One of the things that Richard Stengel has promised Michael Lytton at Sony, if they help again with global terrorism, is that they'll make a lot of profits and there'll be real commercial successes for them. So this kind of unity of a military enterprise, you know, with corporate profits passed off as freedom of expression is really an indication, I think, of the real bankrupt position that mainstream Hollywood finds itself in. And the media repeating these kinds of myths and not revealing what's really going on is complicit in that.
Robin, with the centralized control of information surrounding this film, with the media and the government involvement and this propaganda campaign of hackers, have you ever seen this sort of like centralized control of information around a film? Is this the start of something, or is this a continuation of a process?
A lot of it goes back to World War I, and the film industry really kind of grew up, oddly, during World War I, during this time. And we were in the midst of huge propaganda from the Creel Commission at World War I, and many people take it back to that, and that is really the start. The relationship between Hollywood and the military, of course, took a big hit after Vietnam. There was a huge rebellion against Hollywood narratives, and the Green Beret, which came out, was a pro-Vietnam film in the 60s, was kind of despised by many in Hollywood. And mainstream film came out with a counter-narratives to war after the Vietnam War. You know, you can think of them, Born on the 4th of July, Platoon, Full Metal Jacket, a whole series of films. Where I think we get the real modern phase by the end of the 20th century was 1986 and Top Gun. And it was all of a sudden, it was that formula that got Hollywood back on track with the military, and Tom Cruise as a fighter pilot, and the kind of weaponized masculinity that has really stuck with us in. But, you know, their recruitment jumped 500% when Top Gun came out, and they had actually recruitment booths set up with the airing of the film. So it was the antidote, if you will, to the anti-Vietnam era. It put Hollywood and the military back on track, and they've been, you know, going forward ever since. Those connections and those tentacles of interweaving between Hollywood and the military have become a really tight grip now.
And Robin Anderson, I wanted to close out our discussion, again, returning to the issue of corporate media complicity in this and the military infotainment complex and the fact that the quote-unquote news reporters or journalists in the United States so completely uncritically, as if they were stenographers, just repeating over and over again the propaganda of North Korea hacking Sony and so on. I mean, you know, even, and I know liberals like to look at NPR and PBS and say, well, they're different. They're not like the others. And I mean, even PBS, they signed off one of their NewsHour broadcasts with saying that the FBI stands behind the claim that the North Korea hacked Sony. I mean, there was no evidence, no proof, no questioning. I mean, it's like they ripped it off the wire, they read the press release, and then that was the end of it. And
it wasn't even if you read the press release, Mickey, it wasn't even a convincing press release.
That's the problem here. I mean, this, and of course, under the propaganda model, Chomsky and Herman, this is a problem of sourcing. And I also bring this up because we recently saw a strange admission from NBC's Meet the Press, Chuck Todd, talking about how, well, he can't really ask tough questions because then people won't come back on his show. I mean, essentially admitting the problem of sourcing and essentially saying that he is a very well-paid shill to manage perception. I mean, this is basically the admission that comes out of this.
It is. But, you know, it's their decision. There are so many alternative narratives, so many important things to talk about, so much information that needs to be revealed that
Indeed.
People would be interested. It's not that they're – it's not because they're appealing to the public. It's because they want to keep their profit in technology and their global regulation so that they continue to make profits around the world. And it's really this unity that they find that is more important for their bottom line than giving creative narratives to the public.
And this is why Chomsky and Herman talked about the political economy of mass media, and this is all fueled by capitalism, the wars for imperialism. I mean, these things are all connected, and of course the job, I think, actually, of people like Chuck Todd is to try to keep the public on narrative.
Right, and one of the things that emerged also in some of the emails showed that they had actually altered the content of the interview for the international market for their bottom line. They took some of you mentioned how horrible the violence at the end with the assassination scene was in the interview. Well, they had censored that for the international market. So we come full circle now talking about the interview where our narrative became freedom of expression revolving around a film that in so many ways had revealed itself to be nothing but propaganda. And then for the international market, well, sure, we'll censor that if you play it now in France and it'll make a little bit more money. Well, that was one of the countries that wanted it altered a little bit.
That's, again, amazing to hear. Robin Anderson, we're about out of time for this segment, but any last words or anything you'd like to share with our listeners, websites, places to find your work, etc.?
Yeah, Mickey, one of the reasons I wrote this is I've just finished editing a guest editor for a special edition of a journal called Democratic Communique.
Yes, Union of Democratic Communications. We know
right.
It well.
Your fellow sister institution.
Yes.
And we've had a lot of good collaborations in the past and with conferences. And yes, so that journal article came out and we had written on media and war and kind of the advances of media in a war society. So I had written the article about Act of Valor and in an introduction that I did with my co-editor, we also kind of summarized a lot of the stuff about films in Hollywood that have been, military vehicles. And so I had that at my fingertips and because I had just finished working on that. So that's another source for people who want to read more about this topic.
What is that again? And is there a website?
Yes, it's the Democratic Communique. It's the most current issue of the Democratic Communique, edited by myself. And you can find it on the Union for Democratic Communications website.
Okay, and your recent article on Sony and the interview is on thevisionmachine.com.
Yeah.
Robin Anderson, thanks so much for taking time out and joining us on the Project Censored show today. We hope to run into you again later on this year, maybe even at the conference in Toronto.
Okay, it was a pleasure to be here, Mickey. Bye.
And finally today at the Project Censored show, we'd like to recognize the Charlie Hebdo massacre in Paris, France, and the shocking attack on free expression. Project Censored is a member of the National Coalition Against Censorship and endorsed a statement by NCAC that came out just after the attacks. This is a free speech group's joint statement by NCAC condemning Charlie Hebdo attack. Anyone who values freedom of expression is horrified by the terrorist attacks on the offices of the French satirical weekly Charlie Hebdo. Early reports indicate that 10 of the magazine staffers were killed, including editor Stéphane Charbonnier. Two police officers were also killed on the scene. The magazine has a long history of publishing sharp satirical work that no doubt shocks and offends many readers. The magazine has published material mocking the Pope, Jesus Christ, and French political figures, among others. In 2011, their website was hacked and their offices firebombed after publication of an issue guest edited by Muhammad. The magazine remained committed to publishing material some might find offensive or inflammatory. Some reports say the attackers identified themselves as being affiliated with Al-Qaeda's Yemeni affiliate and were heard saying, quote, "We have avenged the prophet," end quote. After the 2011 firebomb attack, French Prime Minister François Fillon called freedom of expression, quote, "an inalienable right in our democracy," end quote, and that, quote, "all attacks on the freedom of the press must be condemned with the greatest firmness," end quote. That commitment in France and anywhere else should not waver in the face of today's brutality. The National Coalition Against Censorship and many other organizations committed committed to the fundamental value of free expression condemned these hideous and barbaric acts, which represent a chilling and extreme assault on freedom of speech. The failure to stand up for free expression emboldens those who seek to attack and undermine it. That is a statement by the National Coalition Against Censorship, which includes endorsers from the American Booksellers Association, American Booksellers for Free Expression, the ACLU, American Library Association, Comic Book Legal Defense Fund, Free Expression Policy Project, Freedom to Read Project, Project Censored, Media Freedom Foundation, and many others. You can learn more at ncac.org.
We want a liberated land, supporting human conditions, not free market propaganda and corrupt politicians, because they own by special interests.
That's our program for today. Thanks for joining us. The Project Censored Show airs on over 20 stations around the United States. For more information and to listen to archives of previous shows, go to www.projectcensored.org. Please follow and like us on Facebook. Anthony Fest is our producer, Erica Bridgman our engineer. I'm Mickey Huff with guest host Nolan Higdon. Peter Phillips will be back next week. We'll see you next time.